Bouquet. We're in the office of Jim Gardner at Gardner Foods. And about to commence our interview. I had the speaker on there and don't want that on to sound funny. Okay, so we were just saying that the Goldwater campaign was profoundly important for the Republican Party. And to many people that sounds funny because Goldwater lost, crushing defeat. How do you assess his impact on the party in North Carolina and in the South more broadly?
Well, North Carolina specifically, pre-Barry Goldwater, the Republican Party in our state was basically in the Piedmont area. Charlotte and up in that area, and then some old-time base up in the western part of the state. There really was no Republican Party, almost Greensboro East. Maybe Greensboro was the dividing line. My entire life has been spent in Rocky Mount in the eastern part of our state. I didn't know any Republicans. There were no Republicans down here.
Growing up, you never knew a Republican.
I knew one, a wonderful lady who was not from this area, was from up north, moved in here, married a local fellow, was the only Republican I knew, and she would carry the banners and would always, you know, every time I would see her, why don't you become a Republican? And I would think, you know, it's, forget it. Anyway, I came from a very non-political family also. My dad was a registered voter, hated Franklin Roosevelt, and I would hear that conversation going on, but really no political involvement, almost a disdain for politics and politicians as someone in some group you didn't trust and you didn't really get involved with. So in about 1962, I had formed a company, Hardy's Food Systems, with a friend of mine, and we were busily growing and getting involved in some public stock issues and things of that type. And about that time, I got my first taste of being in business, being on my own, and being involved with government, going through federal registrations on our stock issues, and just being aware, really, for the first time, and what was going on in Washington primarily, and how it affected business, and how I felt it was going to affect my future and that of my family. Barry Goldwater came along in about that time, 63, and I started listening and reading some of the things that he said, and as I listened and I read, I began to say, hey, everything this man is saying, I believe, and it's very pro-business, pro-entrepreneurial. Anybody who's willing to get out and take a chance and take a risk, the reward should be there. It can't be there if government's involved in it, and particularly if government's standing in the way. So the more I listened to Barry Goldwater and his beliefs in government, the more interested I became in getting involved in his campaign. The first thing I had to do was to change my registration because I was a registered Democrat. And I found out that a lot of my friends felt the same way. Young business people in this town, we would see each other each week at the Junior Chamber of Commerce meetings. We began to talk about these issues. And we decided that, look, if we really believe what Barry Goldwater stands for, and it looks like he's going to be the nominee of the Republican Party, then we ought to be part of that party. We ought to have competition. And he talked about the value of competition, the exchange of ideas. There was no Republican Party here. So to make a long story short, we, a group of us, I think maybe as many as 15 or 16, who are all members of the Chamber of Commerce, all young businessmen, decided to change our registration. And we all got in the car, three carloads, and went over to Nashville, North Carolina, which was a county seat, went to the courthouse, typical old Southern courthouse, and said, we'd like to change our registration. And the lady stared at us and said, what do you mean, change your registration? We said, change to Republican. And she said, kind of like, are you kidding? And we said, no, we are very serious. She said, well, I don't know if you can do that. And we said, why can't we do it? She said, well, the registrar's not here. And we said, where is he? Well, he's home. And home was about three blocks away. He was sitting on the front porch swinging in a swing. So being young and full of vinegar and everything, we got in the car, drove to his house, marched up, probably scared him to death, and said, we want to change our registration. And he said, you know, you can't do it. And we said, we can, and we know we can. And he said, well, you'll have to wait till I go back to the courthouse. To make a long story short, we changed our registration, and then we decided that we'd have a county convention. And I guess that was my first experience in the fact that we had a state Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I called up and found out the name of the man who was the chairman of the party, told him who I was, what we were doing, that we wanted to establish a Republican Party in this county, in Nash County. And he was naturally delighted. And he
was
came.
That Bill Cobb?
No, that was right after Cobb. It was Herman Saxon, was a state Republican chairman at that time. He was a businessman in Charlotte. And to his credit, he came down immediately, met with us, was very excited and pleased that we were going to do it. We decided to have a convention, which we decided we would hold at the courthouse in Nashville to irritate them as much as we could while we were building the party. And had like 230 or 40 people attend this first convention, elected our delegates, went through the plan of organization. And that was very important to us, not only because we were new and this was all exciting, but because there was going to be a convention coming up in which we wanted very much to help elect Barry Goldwater as a Republican nominee. So we went through the process of forming the party, having the county convention, and then electing delegates to the district, and got very involved in that, and then to the state convention. I was an alternate delegate to San Francisco in that convention in 64. In the meantime, I guess we got so carried away that we said, we have a long-term congressman, Congressman Harold Cooley, who's been in office like 30 or 32 years. I think I was 28 at that time. And he needs some opposition. We need to really make a statement that not only do we have a party, but we're going to run candidates. And I guess maybe my enthusiasm was a little greater than anybody else's. And before I knew what happened, we decided that I would be the candidate. So I had gone from no political involvement to help start it here, and then I was a candidate for Congress. And was a wonderful campaign. I mean, it was all new people, all people who had been Democrats and changed their registration.
Was it disproportionately young people
that followed you? Almost all.
And for the people who followed you and became active Republicans, were you looked at kind of funny? I mean, there's all the lore of the Lost Cause that depicted Republicans as moral blights and troublemakers. Was there any of that opposition?
Some of it. There were some counties in the smaller counties like Johnston County, long-time historical Democrat strongholds. They looked at you like you were crazy, that you were troublemakers. This county, Wake County, it was the most exciting thing that ever happened. I mean, people were getting involved for the first time for the right reasons, because they believed in a cause, and they believed what they were doing would help the country, help their county, help their families. So all the right reasons were there. It was interesting when we had one county that historically was a Republican county in my district, Randolph. And when I would go in there, they didn't want to hear any of the "we're for Goldwater." They wanted you to say, "we're Republicans." And we put up some billboards that said, Goldwater Gardner, conservatives. And when I went up to Randolph County for the first time, and that was probably 2/3 of the Republican primary vote, and I was in a primary against a man from Raleigh, they said, "you got 24 hours to take the signs down."
We're
Republicans, not conservatives. We're Republicans. We happen to be conservative, but we're proud to be Republicans. So in Randolph County, we had Goldwater, Gardner, Republicans. All the rest of them, we had conservative. And I was very aware that when you hit Randolph County, that you were a Republican, and they were proud of it, and they owned the courthouse, everything. So you had to do it. But most of the people involved in my campaign, with the exception of Randolph County, were young people who had never been involved in politics before. And we ran a grassroots campaign, going door to door, knocking on the door. We would go in, for example, areas that nobody had ever been in before, in an apartment project, and knock on every door in the project, 200 apartments, and leave them a brochure, talk to them. We had coffee hours where we would have 8 or 10 women who would come to a neighbor's house, and we would not come in and speak and talk to them. And as the campaign progressed, I won the primary. We really felt we had a chance to win the thing. The Goldwater campaign didn't look very good, and we were very disappointed, but we really thought he'd carry North Carolina. And when it finally was over, he lost everywhere and lost North Carolina. we got 48% of the vote in my congressional campaign. And I guess at that time I was really involved and knew I had to run again. Mm-hmm. And it went from there. But had it not been for Barry Goldwater, I doubt that I would have ever been involved to the extent that I was.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you meet Cliff White at that point in the early Goldwater boom years? Was he somebody?
I met Cliff probably in 63. Mm-hmm. And in 64, when Goldwater came in, we were in contact with Cliff White. Uh-huh.
Was he helpful in teaching you how to organize the county and the precinct, or was that...
No, we pretty well had started up until that time, and you saw very little of him. I mean, Goldwater came in and made two or three appearances in the state. Being a congressional candidate, I got to travel with him, particularly when he was in Raleigh, and I, of course, saw Cliff White. And Cliff, I probably had more contact with him as it pertained to the convention itself,
right,
because that's really what he was... number one interested in, was getting the nomination, and he was kind of the architect who put all of that together, and then he, of course, I guess, ran the campaign, but we didn't see very much of it.
Did that give you a lot of fire for you and your followers, the thought to be able to choose the delegates that would select Goldwater? Was that...
Oh yeah, and to be at San Francisco, you have to go back again and put it in perspective. My first meeting had been, you know, probably less than a year before.
Right.
In a courthouse in Nashville. Now we're in the Cow Palace in San Francisco. And when I heard Goldwater's speech, I thought it was the greatest speech I'd ever heard. And never understood, and don't to this day, how he was panned so badly.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of it because of the speech, which I felt was so great.
The one line there, I know Cliff White himself said that when Goldwater delivered that line, extremism...
Yeah.
In defense of
liberty.
Liberty is no vice, and
exactly.
Moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Yep.
It had come after the repudiation, a bitterly debated repudiation of a John Birch Society sponsored plank, and it was seen as throwing salt in wounds.
Yep.
That's, I think, how Cliff White put it. I mean, I'm sure you've heard that.
Yeah, and it could have been. He probably, you know, had a better view of that. It certainly was not for us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were one of the thousand who was standing there cheering and thought it, you know, it made hair stand up. That Goldwater, and I've been in politics now a very long time, met a lot of people in it. Goldwater was the straightest shooter that I ever met. I mean, what you saw was what he was. I mean, there was, we had a meeting in Raleigh, and I'll never forget, we brought in a large number of tobacco farmers, and we felt we had a chance to at least crack that vote. And that what Goldwater stood for, they really liked. And we were in an old hotel in Raleigh and sitting in a jam-packed room with people. And the meeting started, and Goldwater gave a short few remarks. And then this fellow said, we've heard a rumor that you opposed to tobacco subsidies. And he said, absolutely. And why should you be getting anything that somebody else didn't get? I mean, there was dead silence.
Amazing.
That was the end of the meeting. But I thought to myself, you know, well, this guy is what you see is what he is. I mean, there's not a phony bone in him. He's a straight shooter. What a shame that somebody with that integrity was just wiped out and for all the wrong reasons. I mean,
it backfired because Orville Freeman, the chair of agriculture, would come down and read from Goldwater's book, and you had called it, you know, the political Bible.
Right.
So, it hurt you. I mean,
you might
have won had it not been Goldwater.
Well, I've heard from other people, a little later that all of a sudden the Democrats realized that we might win the congressional race, and they pull out all the stops.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Johnson came in, and the money rolled in, and we really lost the election in about the last 10 days of the campaign. We were probably dead even. And when they brought Johnson in, they started pulling IOUs and poured the money in and just had enough to win. But we knew then we could win the next time.
Mm-hmm. Did you change your campaign focus, tactics in the 66 race, which you did win when you beat Harold Cooley?
Mm-hmm.
You know, from what I've seen in the newspapers, it seems like you're less biting in your criticisms. I didn't know if I was getting, you know, the full flavor of your speeches, or...
I felt that I probably went after Cooley more in the second campaign.
Mm-hmm.
In the first campaign, being new, we kind of tailored our campaign to be very close to Goldwater, because I agreed with what he was saying, and we pretty well ran on the conservative line. The second time around, Johnson's popularity had really dropped. He was a primary target. Mm-hmm. We tried to tie Cooley to Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. and I think we're successful in doing that. I had been the state Republican chairman during 65. That gave me an opportunity to really move around the state, make a lot of speeches, become a better speaker than I had been in 64. We were able to get a debate with him, which we couldn't do in 64. We got one in 66. Mm-hmm. And I think the timing and everything, which is so important in any campaign, the timing was right this time. Probably a little premature in 64, but right in 66. And we worked from early morning until late night, 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. And we just outworked him, and we had thousands of young people where we would go in, and mothers would bring babies with them, and they were stamping envelopes and drinking coffee. And we probably put together the best Republican organization ever put together in this state in a congressional campaign mm-hmm. in that 66 race.
Hmm. What drew all these young mothers in, bringing their babies, and thousands of young people? I've read in newspapers that there were an awful lot of women, too. Is that your recollection?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, they were the backbone of I would do sometimes 6 and 7 coffees a day, where we just go from one area of a town to another, and they would have, sometimes it would be 6 people, sometimes it would be 20 people in someone's home. I don't know if it was the times, Vietnam, we were all young, we'd been in the Goldwater campaign, the disappointment of that. I think in the South, the whole concept of the Republican Party and what the Republican Party stood for was really beginning to come on the scene, and more young people were attracted to it. And I guess also the difference between my age at like 30 or 32, whatever I was in 68, 66, and Mr. Cooley, who'd been in office as long, I mean, there was a stark contrast. Mm-hmm. And that helped us. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He campaigned the same way he campaigned 30 years before. And I'll never forget, we were in a town at the same time, and when it was over that night, we were sitting around just talking, and we remarked in the campaign, the contrast. We went in, we had a planned agenda where we were going. We would have like 5 or 6 coffee hours all over town. We'd then go out and work apartment projects. We would be at a factory when they changed passing out. Mr. Cooley would come in, and he would go downtown to a lawyer's office. And he would sit down, and if you wanted to see him, you came to the lawyer's office, mm-hmm. and you could see him. So maybe he saw 10 people, 12 people mm-hmm. all day, mm-hmm. where we were covering the whole town from early morning until late night and saw everybody and talked to everybody and asked everybody to help. Mm-hmm. He never really asked anybody to help. And I think all of that kind of, you know, together.
Mm-hmm. The News and Observer tried your campaign. My favorite. is a marathon effort, you know. Just,
well, it was.
We worked on the energy. Yeah.
We would start every morning with a breakfast somewhere, and literally we'd either be on the road heading somewhere for another breakfast the next day, or we'd be at, you know, a late night meeting. In fact, I had a fellow who ran a restaurant for me at that time who had been an old Democrat, Ward Hiller, I mean, from the old school, and he came to me one day and he said, I really want to help you in this campaign. I was with Cooley the last time, I think for the right reasons, and it has nothing to do with my working for you because you've never asked me anything about the campaign, but I want to help you. And I said, fine. He said, I'd like to go with you this week. So I had one of these, you know, mobile homes, and we get in there to Winnebago, and we take off, and we go until about 10 o'clock that night, go to a motel. We get up at 6 the next day. We've got a 7 o'clock breakfast, go to 11 o'clock, and he said, wait a minute. When are we going to drink some liquor? We said, that's not what we're out here for. He said, I'm going home. It's no fun. All y'all are doing is working. Well, that, I think, showed the difference. They would sit around an office, 8 or 10 of them, drink, and talk about how they were going to win the campaign. We worked. Mm-hmm. Made a big difference.
The Gardner Special was a Winnebago?
It was a Winnebago, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we just,
when I got off of that at the end of that campaign, I said, I never want to get on another Winnebago. I mean, we were on it like 15 hours a day.
Wow.
Hmm. But it was new. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that we did like that, like the coffee hours, direct mail, we were putting out direct mail every 6 weeks. None of that had ever been done before.
Direct mail. So you would compile lists of everybody who was interested?
We would go down and we get the list of all registered voters, and we would mail about every 6 weeks those voters. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times it would be pamphlets showing Cooley and myself, and then we'd list what we stood for, each one of us, always with a picture of Cooley and Lyndon Johnson on it.
Okay.
To tie him to it. Mm-hmm. And we really worked the direct mail. Mm-hmm. Very limited TV. It was just so expensive. Mm-hmm. But heavy direct mail. And the housewives who had these parties, mm-hmm. the purpose of having a coffee hour was twofold, so that I could meet them, let them know what I stood for. The other, to acquire volunteers to address envelopes on the direct mail. Mm-hmm. We'd take the list and do all the envelopes ourselves. And we tried to personalize it where if you got it. In fact, I think the best thing we probably did, we had my wife write a letter right toward the end of the campaign, and the printer did a wonderful job. It just said, "Dear friend," mm-hmm. but it looked exactly like she had written that letter to your wife. Mm-hmm. And we mailed it to every female in the district. Mm-hmm. And it just basically said, "I just wanted to take this time to write you and ask you to consider voting for my husband. He's a good husband. He's a good father. Mm. He cares about our state." She must have gotten 250 letters back from women who wrote her back saying, you know, that you would take time in the middle of this campaign to sit down and write. They never realized that it was really, a mass mailing, a machine. Mm. She had written the letter, and I wish we could have written individually to every person, but you couldn't do that.
Sure.
But the response was tremendous. Most of those women had never gotten a letter, mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. And even today, I think politicians forget too often how important that housewife is, mm-hmm. who's sitting at home in a lot of cases every day looking after, raising children, mm-hmm. and it's all the husband and never her. We wanted to single her out, that when she went to that poll, we had women who walked in holding the letter. And some of our people say, "Well, you know, we had ladies who came in with Marie's letter." The letter became known as Marie's letter,
Marie's
in fact.
Letter.
So I think if you look at 66, how did we win? We worked. We were better organized than we were in 64. We worked probably a little bit harder, had a lot more experience, and times were different. Mm-hmm. Johnson was unpopular where he was popular in 64.
Mm-hmm. Very different situation. Oh. Why was he so disliked? Would the Voting Rights Act had been passed, or is it a lot of that Great Society legislation that was so heralded?
I think both of those, and I think people realized that he lied about Vietnam. They remembered that they showed the mushroom with Barry Goldwater, mm-hmm. and Lyndon Johnson was saying at that time, "No American is going, your son's not going over there to fight." Mm-hmm. And by 66, we were up to here in Vietnam, in trouble, and I think people really began to say, you know, this guy was not honest. Mm-hmm. He didn't tell the truth. I like to think they said, "We made a mistake in 64. We're going to rectify it this time." Mm-hmm. And then a couple with the hard work we put in, and I guess the combination of all of it kind of came about.
Mm-hmm. And when you went to Congress, you continued to refine the direct mail approach,
right.
Is that correct? By
yes.
pooling machines with George Bush and
right.
other congressmen and setting up?
Again, the contrast, when we came in, we had done some polling early in the campaign in 64 and found out that like 50 to 60% of the people didn't know who the congressman was. Hmm. Well, he had no congressional office in the district. His congressional office was his law office in Nashville. Mm-hmm. He had never sent out any mail to anybody. There had been no correspondence. We made a determination that if we won, they were going to come after us, and we knew that with everything they had. So we had 2 years to really establish contact with the constituents in the district. We set up a congressional office in each county, and I would hold regular office hours there. That had never been done before. I mean, he didn't even have an office. We would send out regular mailings, which we pooled with George Bush, who was in his first year, and some others, out of a central point, and we would let them know what legislation was going on, how it affected them, how I was going to vote on it. We did a lot of that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also did television and radio. we would send to the TV stations spots that we cut in Raleigh, in Washington, and amazingly, they played them.
So you just hand them the footage of your
We'd
own.
Hand it, and they would put it on the news. Wouldn't do that now, but they did then. Same thing with the radio stations.
With your direct mailings, you would send those out at your own expense, is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
And I heard it described once as a congressional club. You set up a congressional club with a list of names and mailings. And then you gave that list to Jesse Helms in 73, is that right?
72 when he ran, yeah, the first time. Yeah, I ran, let me go back one second. When I first ran in 64, and this was when I first got my real taste of what real gut politics is, or gutter politics. When I ran in 64 and came close, within months, the legislature changed the district. They said, well, Gardner came close this time, we better change this. They took out a couple of the counties that I had carried in 64 and gave me Orange County, which had been the most Democrat county, or one of them in the entire state, Chapel Hill, and I've forgotten the other. We changed the district, though. Well, we ended up carrying Orange County and won the election. Well, the minute I won the election, they came back and they took this county, Nash, my home county, out, put me in the second district with L.H. Fountain, the most conservative of the Democrat congressmen. So almost before I really got to Washington and settled in, I had to make a decision. I either had to run against L.H. Fountain, and it was basically no difference in us, what we believed in, just difference in the parties. I probably could not have beaten him. I had to move my family to Raleigh and settle down there. My wife was very much opposed to that. This was home. And run against Nick Galifianakis, another freshman congressman. Our poll showed we could have maybe beat him. But it would have meant moving, or get out of politics, and I'd just gotten in, or do something else. And at that time, I said, well, you know, I'll run for governor. I felt that, and other people did, the timing was right that we now had a statewide party that, with the base Republican vote being Greensboro West, and what we'd done down here, if you put the two of them together, we had a real shot at it. And I ran against a very tough Democrat with a very strong name, Bob Scott, whose dad had been governor of this state. And we got 48% of the vote. I ran way ahead of Nixon in North Carolina because of the three-way split.
Wallace.
Yeah, Wallace. And, of course, the News and Observer spent the entire campaign trying to tie me to George Wallace. And I guess It was a weird campaign because of those three presidential candidates. You had a very hard time not distancing our campaign from Richard Nixon's, because we never tried to do that at all. But you didn't want to go out and turn off all the Wallace people. And that was dumb because they were all Democrats.
It was the key to Eastern Carolina.
And they were all Democrats. Every one of them, almost 100%, were registered Democrats. We wanted that vote. It was out there. So we had to kind of walk a real tightrope, being Republicans, being conservatives. So what we tried to do was, Wallace would say, for example, there's one of the dimes worth of difference. And I would try to say, but there is. And, you know, just look at the difference between Humphrey and Richard Nixon. And without offending the Wallace people or saying anything bad about George Wallace, we would try to talk about the difference between our two major candidates. And I really don't know what would have happened had it been a two-way race. I probably think we maybe would have won the thing. I don't think we got all the Wallace vote because most of them were hard rock Democrats. And then I got involved in the Republican convention in 68 and supported Ronald Reagan and actually gave one of his seconding speeches for his nomination. That really hurt up in Charlotte and up in that area. And a lot of people have told me since that time, you're doing that cost you the election. I don't know if it did or not, but it didn't help us any.
It did anger a lot of people.
Oh,
I know a past gubernatorial candidate, Frank Patton, was incensed over that.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the old Nixon men who really feared Wallace would take the state.
Yep.
I mean, it was never a race between Humphrey and Nixon.
Oh, no.
It was always Wallace and Nixon.
Yep.
Well, you had
And see, had I gotten
the Charlotte folks by not declaring right off for governor, and Jack Stickley had entered the race, and so there was a very clean Republican primary, but it hurt a lot of people, I think, to have to fight and then lose Jonas and
it did
some of those old guard Republicans.
Yeah, when I beat Stickley in that primary, and he was Jonas's candidate and an outstanding man. When I beat him and then went for Ronald Reagan, that killed me in Charlotte. And every time I've ever run in Charlotte, I've lost Charlotte. Not in primaries, but in the general election. And I think it all goes back to 1968, that first time. When I lost to Jim Holzhouse in 72 in the primary, the whole campaign was Mecklenburg County. I carried majority of the counties, but I lost Mecklenburg by such a large majority that Jim won the second, primary. So 68 was an interesting campaign, a lot like 92 with those three candidates in there, but more different because the race here was Nixon and Wallace, not Humphrey.
Anything you wish you'd done differently? On the other hand, coming out early for Reagan, some people say that now makes you look wise. I don't know.
Well, I like Ronald Reagan was, of course, it was, he was like Barry Goldwater and a man of, I thought, great, great principle. I couldn't, very honest, very sincere, better delivery than Goldwater had, naturally. And when he came down here, he was what I was looking for in the Republican Party, not Richard Nixon. Although Nixon, had been a great Republican and he'd come in and spoken for me and in the campaign, and I'd had a chance to meet him several times. His philosophy and my philosophy were not the same. Mine was what Barry Goldwater stood for and what Ronald Reagan stood for. And when Reagan asked me if I would, help him, I said yes, and I did it out of principle. I also did it because I felt that in the South, where we were the emerging Republican future, that by just rolling over dead and handing it to Richard Nixon, we were going to get nothing.
That's right.
And I sat down with Strom Thurmond and tried to, who was heading up South Carolina for Nixon, and said, let's try a couple of ballots. Let's see what happens.
When did you say this to Strom Thurmond?
When we got down in Miami, if we had some competition, if Reagan was in there after the first, I still believe to this day, had Strom Thurmond decided to go with Ronald Reagan on the first ballot, Ronald Reagan would have gotten the nomination, because I think Nixon would have gotten progressively weaker as each vote came about. And with all those new Goldwater Republicans, not only in the South, but out West also, and Reagan being from California, I think that convention, you would have seen it just all of a sudden start a momentum, and who knows what would have happened.
A lot of people write about that convention.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that.
Who knows what would have happened if in 1968 Ronald Reagan would have been president.
Well, what did Strom Thurmond say to you? Did he agree that competition was good and this would be some interesting leverage to hold Nixon in line and show him he can't take the South for granted?
He did, but he said, but I have a commitment to Nixon, and I think with my commitment to him that he'll listen to me. And that when we sit down and talk about his administration, I'll have a strong voice in it, that he felt he was that strong within the Nixon organization. I don't think it turned out to be that way, but he had a commitment. He lived up to it, so you certainly had to respect him for that. He had committed early.
And what did you sense in Nixon in that early period in 68 that you were uncomfortable with that made Reagan more appealing? There was something in Nixon there that
I think primarily I liked Ronald Reagan. It was more that his philosophy and mine, I liked the man. I liked everything about him. I never was really comfortable with Nixon. He was a brilliant man. And this is a little thing, but it always bothered me. He'd never look at you. When you were talking to him, he would talk, but he would always be talking out here and there like he was talking to somebody else. But I think, in all honesty, it was really, I liked Ronald Reagan. And I like what he stood for. And he had been, a great governor of California. And I thought we had, we'd been through talking about conservative government with Goldwater. And the time was not right. I felt in 68, maybe the time was now right. And he was a man who could, you know, really lead us. And we just never could get strong Thurman. And he was the key. Without him, you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But that was interesting.
A lot of might have been there. It's just...
Oh, yeah.
Because Watergate, of course, crushed the party.
Oh, it did. By then, I had gone... I was basically out because I had lost in the primary to Holzhauser. I had helped all I could in the general election with Holzhauser and Jesse Helms. Then they won, and then I kind of got out and went back to trying to be a father and a husband and earn a living. And then Watergate hit. So Jim Holzhauser, really being an incumbent governor at that time, he got the whole brunt of Watergate and those who were in office. And it was, I mean, it almost devastated the party. You can imagine the Raleigh News and Observer writing every day about Watergate. I mean, it was like if you were a Republican and you wanted to go hide under a rock somewhere.
So, going back to the 60s, and thinking about your congressional club, I've heard it said that that was, in some respects, a precursor to Jesse Helms' congressional club, with a focus on direct mail and fundraising. Would you agree with that, or is...
I think maybe in a smaller way, because it was a congressional campaign, although we then carried it in 68 and did the same thing statewide. We used an awful lot of direct mail, fundraising-wise and otherwise. I think the Helms people took it and carried it to another level through their organization, which is probably the most efficient money-raising operation ever put together, maybe in the country. Of its kind.
Might well be.
And we started a lot of those things but they were beginning to take place all across the country. It was a quick, inexpensive way to get very close to somebody very quickly. TV was becoming more expensive and harder to use. So that was one of the reasons that we used it.
To what do you attribute the rise of a two-party system in North Carolina?
I think probably if you had to say one thing, it was Goldwater's candidacy. All of the people who were involved in my congressional campaign in 64, all of the people who worked for me, Raleigh East, and a lot of them, surprisingly, in other areas of the state, like Charlotte, we all got involved at the same time when Barry Goldwater ran in late 63 and 1964. I think probably more than anything that started it, because it brought in a lot of young people who had never been politically active. And they all came in, I thought, for the right reasons, because of philosophy, not because they were interested in a job or interested in any kind of patronage. They were interested in a philosophy of government, and they felt that by working and being part of it, they could make a difference. And he was a catalyst that really brought him in 64 in his campaign. And most of them amazingly stayed in. When I ran for lieutenant governor in 88, I'd been out of politics since 72. The same people, basically, who were in my last campaign were the people who were in my lieutenant governor's campaign some 20 years later. Every one of them got in 1964 and stayed in. Never got out. It's, you can go all throughout the state, and we sat down one time in 88 and said, you know, this is amazing. As we look at our organization in all 100 counties, probably two-thirds of them were Goldwater people that I first met in 64.
That's quite a bit of longevity.
It really is. And I guess the reason why is we were all so young. We were all 25, 26, 27, 28 years old. Got in and not only got in, but jumped in the middle of it. It wasn't like we were just out passing out stickers.
Right.
We were in the middle of it.
Well, that was one of the things about the Republican Party is the youth party. A 30-year-old could be the state chairman.
Exactly.
Or run for Congress. Or
right. Run for governor.
Even run for governor.
Yeah, I was 36 when I ran for governor in 68. Holzhauser was, when he was elected governor, was 30-something?
Yes. He was younger than you by, I think, 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years, yeah.
About 37.
And if you looked at our party from maybe, it was always said that Charlie Jonas was Mr. Republican. That wasn't true. Charlie Jonas was a great congressman, but he was only interested in his district. He wasn't really interested in a state party, seeing the party. When we had our first real big rally down here, we invited him to come, and at first he couldn't come. He didn't have time.
And was that first rally a draft Jonas for governor rally?
Well, he got very upset that we got that. We felt that with his name recognition and kind of the one guy who'd been kind of the darling of the newspapers and very effective congressman from the Mecklenburg area, that he could have really been elected governor. Mm-hmm. And he wanted a part of it. Boy, he got mad as fire with us and said, forget it. I'm happy right where I am. And he was a wonderful congressman. Mm-hmm. Nobody worked any harder or knew the budget any better than he did, and was very, very effective, and the people of Charlotte were lucky. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he really ever said, my goal is to build a two-party system in this state. I don't think that was his goal. I think his goal was to be an effective representative from his district. Mm-hmm. And boy, he was.
I know even the News and Observer said he was the most powerful politician from North Carolina, counting senators, Democratic senators, everybody.
Yeah, because of ability. 68. Yeah, because I think of ability. He concentrated and almost had tunnel vision on his job in Washington. Mm-hmm. He wasn't interested in being governor. Mm-hmm. He wasn't interested in being a United States senator. Mm-hmm. He was a congressman, and he was on a very powerful committee, and he did his job well, mm-hmm. and he knew what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. When Charlie Jonas would stand up, and I've heard him many times, talk about the budget, I mean, he knew what he was talking about, mm-hmm. and he would talk for hours. Mm-hmm. But he was a very effective congressman.
And he would pretty much avoid intra-party fighting and that sort of
thing. Only time I think he ever got involved was for Jack Stickley, and that was mm-hmm. because they were great personal friends, mm-hmm. and I understood that. Mm-hmm. Not only were they from the same area, but Mr. Stickley had been his campaign manager, mm-hmm. and I totally understood it. Mm-hmm. It was the only time I know he ever got involved. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Helms is a lot like that. He doesn't get involved in primaries. Very often. He'll wait till the primary's over, but he won't get involved normally in a primary.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the Congressional Club's willingness to get involved in primaries and spill blood is part of what has led to the break between Helms and the club, or is that more the financial matters?
I don't really know. I think it's... Helms is an unusual politician. And I'm only giving you my observation. He hates politics. He hates the getting out there and shaking hands and going, and doesn't do much of it. Most people don't realize that. A Helms campaign's about 2 weeks. He's always in Washington. First one wasn't, because he was working to get it, but ever since he's been elected, he will not miss any votes up there. He's going to be up there, which I admire him for, but it always restricts the time that he's actually down here campaigning. So his campaigns, as far as his involvement, normally are not very long, and he never has cared for it. The Congressional Club pretty much just did what they wanted to. Tom Ellis and Carter Wren, Jesse wasn't involved in the day-to-day operations. I don't think he had any idea how much money they were raising, who was making what, how the money was spent, or anything else. His focus was Washington. And I don't know that if all of a sudden, I think there was a split among some of the people in the club, and they came to Jesse and said, do you know how much these people are making? Do you know how much money they're raising? Do you know they send out letters and you don't ever see them? And apparently they developed a split there, but I don't know that firsthand. I think he's going to miss the Congressional Club in the next campaign. You might not agree with them, and they do play hardball, but they are an incredible political organization, have been in the past. Not only Jesse Helms, what, 3 times? John East?
Actually, four times. 3 times.
Yeah, 3 times. And John East.
String of congressmen.
These guys are about as good as you can get politically. They play hardball, and a lot of people resent that within the party. They do get involved in primaries, which probably hurt him some. People couldn't believe that he didn't know that they were going on, but in all honesty, he didn't. I mean, he was preoccupied up there, and just didn't care.
Now, how well did you get to know Jesse Helms in the early 60s when you were a congressman and state chairman?
Very well.
I've seen letters talking about dinner parties at I. Beverly Lake's house with you and he.
Yeah, Jesse, of course, was at WRAL, the executive vice president, had a very strong television show. And I would, every time I was in Raleigh, I would probably see him and visit with him and talk. And although he wasn't a Republican, he was a registered Democrat at that time, and never actively got involved other than a visit over to Dr. Lake's back in '64 to try to get him to support Barry Goldwater. I saw a lot of him, probably more then than I did after he was elected.
Sure, he's busy.
He stays in Washington mainly. Yeah. I mean, you don't see Jesse down in the